are listening to a talk given at the Brisbane City Bible Forum. We hope you enjoy the presentation.
I think we in the West, in Australia and in Brisbane in particular, live in a world saturated in pleasure. I mean, apart from maybe today and yesterday, just look at our winters. We live in a world saturated with pleasure. There's so much pleasure that we don't even think about it. We're immersed in it. Have you noticed just how big the chocolate section in Coles has become? It just goes on and on and on, and we take it for granted. I had a friend who grew up not that long ago in Qatar, in the Middle East. She had never seen chocolate until she came to Australia. And she ate so much, she made us all sick. We are immersed in it. Our homes are filled with pleasure. Think of the television for your viewing pleasure. Think of your electric blanket for your heating pleasure. Think of our coffee machines for our tasting pleasure. But it's all a little bit disguised. I'm not sure how often when you think of those things, you think about pleasure directly. See, when you listen to the ads on TV selling those things, what do you hear? You hear words like comfort, convenience, security. When was the last time you heard them say, pleasure, this is just for your pleasure, this is just not something you need, it's just for your sheer, unadulterated pleasure. When was the last time you heard that ad? You don't hear it. But watch ads closely. Watch the faces of the people on television as they sit down on that lounge chair. What are they actually selling when they sit on that leather recliner? Pleasure. What are they selling when they sell that television and the people gather around it? Pleasure. Just, MasterChef has just finished. Thank goodness my wife's addiction is now, I don't know if it's broken, but it's soon to be ended, right? And what is the show all about? It's all about George Columbaris's face when he tastes that food and, oh, the pleasure. It's about food and aspiration and cuisine, but actually it's about, the camera always zooms in when the judge is, it's about pleasure. See, I finally found an honest advertiser. It's the guy who owns Chanel. Here's what he says. We're in the business of selling pleasure. We do not sell handbags or haute couture, high culture. We sell dreams. Pleasure. We live in a world rich with pleasure. But here's an interesting thing. Is that bad or is it good? See, so far, it sounds like it could be negative, but actually, I want to put it to you, pleasure is profoundly and amazingly good, kind of. And I'm going to draw that out. So our thinker here, he's kind of exploring how should we live? Where does meaning come from? What's life about? And most people posit that it's probably Solomon. I think that makes good sense. At the end of chapter one, he says, look, I've grown in wisdom. I was the wisest guy in the city. I was the wisest guy in the area. I knew what I was thinking. But he gets to the end of chapter one, and he says, look, with much wisdom comes much sorrow. The more knowledge, the more grief. That's right, isn't it? I mean, if you spend all your time talking to academics, you're sad. If you spend all your time watching the news, you're really sad. He goes, that's it. I'm done with just sheer raw knowledge. You can see there the start of chapter two. He says, all right, I'll now test myself with pleasure to find out what is good. Come now, I'll test you with pleasure. But almost immediately, he gives the conclusion straight away. He says, that also proved to be vanity. Some translations say meaningless. That's a little bit unhelpful. Vanity is like, it's not substantial. Scott used the illustration last week of vapor. It's like mist. That looks really substantial. But when you get to the mist, it's kind of not there. It's back over there, and it's over there. And then when the sun comes, it's gone. It's vapor. Even pursuing pleasure was vapor. It's like when you have a shower, you breathe out in the mirror for a moment, it's foggy. Just give it a second or two, and the vapor is gone. He's saying, well, I pursued pleasure, but that proved to be vanity. He kind of puts his conclusion right at the front, and then he kind of digs us into it. He says, look, laughter. Laughter is foolish, and what does pleasure accomplish? So I tried laughter and I tried cheering myself with wine, but he didn't get completely blotto. My mind still guiding me with wisdom. I wanted to see what was worthwhile for men to do under heaven. So I got fully into this, but I never lost control. That's kind of what he said. A responsible drinking, I guess. So what do you think when you hear that laughter is foolish? Is it persuasive? But we love laughter, and yet, have you noticed how fleeting it is? I went to a comedy show earlier in the year. I was really looking forward to it. It was called Tripod. They used to be on Triple J when I was in my teenage years. They could make music about anything. I was so looking forward to the show. It was fantastic. It lasted about 50 minutes. And then it was gone. And we stood around with our friends, you know, other friends kind of went there, and we spent about 20 minutes rehearsing all the jokes I told. And what did it accomplish? I mean, it was fun, but it was gone. Trying to put you in his space, he's really committed himself to the comedy here. That's our problem. We just get it in small doses, and we think, oh, it's really important. It is in small doses, but when you're saying, is this good for my life to be about this? Imagine watching episode after episode after episode of comedians on YouTube. How long do you reckon you'd last before you went, what am I doing here? It just stops being funny after a while and it becomes tedious. He talks about wine. That's the ultimate fleeting pleasure, isn't it? It tastes good for as long as it's in your mouth. As soon as you swallow, it's gone. That's why you leave it in the cellar for so long. Because you're actually trying to prolong the pleasure. I think you're trying to stretch out the pleasure. You know it's going to be good, but as soon as you have it, it's gone. So don't yet have it. Just think about having it for as long as you can. Because once you have it, it's gone. Bill Watterson draws Calvin and Hobbes cartoons, and I love this. Calvin and Hobbes say this, and Calvin says, when you have something, you take it for granted and it's boring. When you get something, it's new and exciting. But everything you get is soon something that you have. So everything new turns into something boring. His conclusion, pleasure is but a passing break. Pleasure comes, pleasure goes. Enjoy it, but it accomplishes nothing. So he's actually just, in a sense, written off pure hedonism. He said, look, if you just give yourself to just straight, raw pursuit of pleasure, step back for a moment. Can you see you've accomplished nothing? What about industrial pleasure? That's what he turns to next, industrial pleasure. So he says, I wanted to actually see what was worthwhile for people to do under the heavens. So then, next section, I undertook great projects, and he lists them out. Can you see it there? I built houses, I planted vineyards, I made gardens and parks, I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them and watched them grow. I made reservoirs, I bought male and female slaves, and I had other slaves, and then I also kind of went out and made it become a massive grazier. I owned herds and flocks more than anyone else. And I amassed silver and gold, the treasure of kings. I acquired entertainment, the ancient version of Netflix, men and women singers, something a little bit darker than Netflix in the next line, a harem as well. Notice what he says there. The delights of the heart of men. Basically, he says, whatever excited people, whatever was good and enjoyable and people aspired to, I went for it. And just in case, you're not sure if he really has experienced it, he says, I became far greater than anyone in Jerusalem before me. In all of this, my wisdom stayed with me. The way I think of him a little bit here is, I couldn't find it online, Arnold Schwarzenegger, a couple of decades ago, was interviewed by Oprah Winfrey, and she said to him, Arnold, does wealth, you know, make you happy? It doesn't, does it? And he said, no, that's right, Oprah. I'm no happier now that I have $42 million than when I had $39 million. And he's making a point like, yeah, I'm happy. So this guy is basically, he's just again asserting, look, if anyone would know what this experience is like. It's me. I have gone all out. Now, some people are a bit shocked at this. They think, really, is this in the Bible? Here's a little bit from 1 Kings about Solomon. Yeah, and it probably is Solomon. He accumulated chariots and horses. He had 1,400 chariots and 12,000 horses. The king made silver as common in Jerusalem as stones, and cedar as plentiful as sycamore and fig trees. But he was also the king, and I think he's writing this late in his life. I think there's some hints as you read Ecclesiastes, he's writing this late in his life. He's also the king who walked away from God because he walked after the hot women of the Middle East. 1 Kings chapter 11, it says Solomon had, catch this, 700 wives of royal birth and 300 concubines. That is a lot of time in the bedroom. And let me just leave it there. He gave himself to this. And actually, because he, you know, without getting him, I think because he walked away from God, he really did give himself to it. That's part of the story. He had the power and position to enjoy everything. Riches, entertainment, food, sex, achievement, power, status, security, comfort, you name it. He experienced it. Verse 11 is sobering. Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was vanity, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. He says, when you looked at the end of the balance sheet, the profit was nothing. The profit was nothing. Why is that? Well, we're going to get to that a little bit. But let me just see if I can prove his experience with some quotes from some real people currently alive. Well, I'm not sure if they're all of them currently alive. Anyone a fan of Alice Cooper?
Yeah.
Shock Rock? Yeah, I like to hear it. Is he in Australia at the moment? Or touring or something? Because I saw an interview, an interview with him in a magazine just on the weekend, so I thought he was current. And he talks about how he started this rock band in the late 60s, 70s, 70s, just at the time when rebellion, you know, was coming in, and the Beatles, you know, mum and dad used to love Beatles, and the Beatles rebelled, and it was like perfect timing, and he soon became like so famous and so rich and so wealthy. And he said, I had it all. What was it like to have it all? This is what he said. All of a sudden, you have all the candy in the world and no clue how to deal with it. And you might be able to think of some people like that. The Home Alone kid, Macaulay Culkin, he's got his life a bit sorted out now, but if you remember, multi-millionaire as a kid, completely off the rails. Lindsay Lohan, the girl from Mean Girls? That wasn't called Mean Girls? Anyway, yeah, I'm with your sister. Even older. What about this? So that's, you know, that's just kind of fame. What about sex? Patricia Wirikun shared this with me. She's a sexologist in Sydney and gave a lecture for us a few years ago. She shared this from Virginia Eisner, a British journalist from the 1960s. Said this about sex. After a decade of sleeping around pretty indiscriminately, girls of the 60s eventually became fairly jaded about sex. It took me years to discover that continual sex with different partners is, with very few exceptions, joyless, uncomfortable, and humiliating. And it's only now I'm older that I've discovered that one of the ingredients of a good sex life, oh, I missed this bit, is that at the very least a grain of affection between the two partners involved. Would I go back to the swimming 60s? Never. In another article I read of hers, she said sex in her 20s and 30s was, catch this word, grim. Because she just pursued sex for the sake of pleasure. What about materialism? This is a few years old, but it still holds true in all sorts of research. From, I think the author's Clive Hamilton, a book called Affluenza, about a decade old, wrote this, and you can just see this all over the web. The arguments and the data show that successfully pursuing materialistic goals fails to increase one's happiness. When people and nations, whole nations, make progress in the materialistic ambitions they experience, some temporary improvement in mood, but it is likely to be short-lived and superficial. So that's partly why our author says it's vanity. He experienced it, and then it's gone. What did it achieve? What did it change? What substance did it bring to the world? That's true of materialism, it's true of money, and it's true of experiences. It's true of experiences. You just again and again hear of athletes, people pursuing experiences. A guy called Joe Simpson, great mountaineer, conquers this great mountain, one of the first people to do it, and he talks about his book touching the void, that when he got to the top, what did he feel? Emptiness. Because now that he was at the top of the mountain, the experience was over. And all he had was the long climb down. And so if you pursue experiences, what do? Well, if that's how your pursuit of pleasure works, you just got to keep pursuing what? The next experience. But it has to be slightly bigger and slightly better to get that same reaction. See, the pursuit of pleasure for the sake of pleasure is a failure. It's fleeting. He says, what did it gain? It was good while it lasted, but what did it gain? It's diminishing returns. You can't hold on to it. And if you live for it, it's so destructive. Sounds pretty bleak. And yet, look how he ends. Verse 24, strange. There is nothing better. A man can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in his work. This too I see is from the hand of God, for without him who can eat or find enjoyment? But actually, did you notice that? He says, it's good to eat and drink. It's good to find satisfaction in your toil. There's good pleasure. What's going on? How does this work? See, it's actually because pleasure is a good gift from God. And that's actually threaded through this chapter, but we missed it. See, pleasure is a gift from God. Pleasure is appointed to God because it's his gift. Come back into that text, and I skipped over it in verse 10. He says, I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. Then there's this fascinating line. My heart took delight in all my work. And this was the reward for all my labor. See, where was the pleasure found? It was actually found not in the end, but in the work itself. In the very labor in life was where the joy was. It was actually saying, when I sought to gain something at the end and achieve greatness and pleasure from the end product, it was nothing. But when I was in the process of just living it out and planting gardens and building vineyards, and, you know, strangely enough, collecting the concubines of my harem, that's kind of, it was actually the joy was in the doing. You know, it's kind of, as they say, it's the journey. He's saying the pleasure comes in the process. See, I think this is a big clue for how pleasure works. Pleasure, when it's pursued as an end point, eludes us. Pleasure, sought to gain on its own terms, fails us. It's fleeting and it's gone. But pleasure, when it just kind of unfolds in the order of life that you give yourself to, is meaningful and changes things. Viktor Frankl, who was a Holocaust survivor, wrote this book, Man's Search for Meaning. He doesn't quite talk about pleasure, but he says this, touching on the same idea. Don't aim at success. The more you aim at it and make it a target, the more you're going to miss it. For success, like happiness, or you could put in pleasure, cannot be pursued. It must ensue. And it does so only as the unintended side effects of one's dedication to a greater cause than oneself, or as the byproduct of one's surrender to a person other than oneself. Happiness, he goes on, happiness must happen, and the same holds for success. Do you see what he's saying? It comes to you when you actually live for something else, something greater, or for another person. And he talks about the people who in the Holocaust, in the camps, who were all about, had lived for their pleasure, and tried and were crushed because they couldn't enjoy anything and couldn't work out how to find enjoyment, were destroyed by despair. Whereas when you lived to try and care for the people around you, when you lived to try and find enough food and share that, when you lived for something greater than just your own comfort or convenience, you somehow found meaning to sustain life, even in the Holocaust camp. See, pleasure, success, happiness, they come as a byproduct. But here's an interesting tension. A philosopher called David Chalmers, he teaches philosophy at an Australian uni. He said, he's talking about happiness, we have the right to pursue happiness, but even when nothing external gets in the way, people don't seem to be all that good at the pursuit. And we'll come to why that is a bit later. But see, here's the conclusion. Don't pursue it. If it doesn't work to pursue it, don't pursue it. You might be thinking, why doesn't it work to pursue it? Look at that text down at the end again, verse 24. A man can do nothing better than to eat and drink and find satisfaction in his work. This too I see is from the hand of God. It doesn't follow necessarily all the time. It's a gift. It's given. See what he says? For apart from him, who can eat or find any enjoyment? In chapter 6 of Ecclesiastes, he says, a man can have everything, but if he cannot find satisfaction, it was better if he was never born. He's saying, it's actually a gift. We think there's kind of direct causes in life, that we're pure agents. He's saying that's actually not the way the world works. There is goodness and pleasure and joy and happiness in the world because of a good God who shares it out abundantly, and you get it and experience it actually because he gives it to you. He gives it to you. And see, behind the reason pleasure is good in the Bible's estimation, unlike some other belief systems, is because of a good God who made a good creation. Let me just touch on here. The Apostle Paul, and this is an obscure text, and I think it's important. The Apostle Paul writes to his protege, Timothy. He's writing to Timothy about he's telling him how to do ministry now that Paul is going to die. Well, not yet dying, but he's kind of laying out ministry and how to care for the church. He's giving Timothy kind of the instructions on what it means to be someone who shares Jesus and lives that out. In the middle of chapter 4, he suddenly starts talking about the goodness of creation and false teachers. You think actually it's an odd place for it. See, Paul says to Timothy, look, down the track, there are people who were Christians who will walk away from Christian teaching. And in fact, he says, they will follow deceiving spirits and demons. They will believe hypocritical lies. There will be this terrible false teaching in the church. And then he tells you what that false teaching is. Do you know what it is? The false teaching that will be calamitous and ruinous is that they will teach that the physical world is not good, and that relationships with the opposite sex is bad, and that marriage is bad, and by implication, sex is bad, and a bunch of foods are bad. Let's see if I've got it here. Oh, yeah. You're right. That is Hugh Jackman, who apparently is being filmed in a movie to play the Apostle Paul. Apparently. And I just thought, put his picture up there. Here's what Paul says. The false teachers forbid people to marry and order them to abstain from certain foods. He's saying a rejection of the good world and the goodness in the world is actually what evil spiritual forces teach. Why? For everything God created is good, and nothing is to be rejected as received with thanksgiving because it's consecrated by the word of God and prayer. Paul's saying, the world is good. All sorts of food, even sugar, is good. And sex is good in the context of marriage. But he's saying everything God created is good. Why is there so much pleasure in the world? Because God is good and created a good world. And then the language there of good is Paul picking up on Genesis, at the end of 6 days of creation, Genesis chapter 1. Then God says, he looked at the world and everything he made and declared it very good. It's kind of like summarizing everything is really, really good. See, pleasure is a good gift from God. A good gift from God. I'm trying to remember if I put this in the next quote. No, I didn't. So how do we think about it? Coming to the conclusion now. I can see as Lewis picks it up really well in the story of Prince Caspian. Right at the end of Prince Caspian, the god Bacchus, the wild god of pleasure, appears into the story. And there's cavorting, and there's wine, and there's food. And Susan turns to Lucy and says, I wouldn't have felt safe with Bacchus and his wild girls if we'd met them without Aslan. I should think not, said Lucy, perhaps a little primly. It's saying, actually, when you understand the goodness of the world and its pleasures in the context of who God is, it helps you actually understand them and enjoy them rightly. Coming to the conclusion. See, God's made this world so rich in goodness that even those who don't know him benefit from it. It overflows. It's like a children's birthday party. I've got four children. Usually just one of them is invited, but, you know, family dynamics. A sibling gets invited along. He's not been invited specifically to the party, but what does he usually get at the party? The party food, the party games. He doesn't know the parents. He doesn't know the kid often. He's not even invited. And he just gets the benefit of the party and the goodness. That's what God's goodness is like. It just overflows. All of us are in his party. But see, we can pursue pleasure without God because he has made the world full of goodness. He's so generous that he's just laced it into the world. And we kind of try and reach it without him. But what did your mum teach you when you received a gift? What did she teach you to say? Anyone?
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, to acknowledge the giver. Could you imagine going to a party that you weren't invited to and just taking and taking and taking and taking? Imagine if someone did that at your party. What would you do? And harass the other guests, ate all the good food. Would you let them stay?
You wouldn't invite them back.
Yeah, would you boot him out? An amazing promise there at the end. Let me read it. Verse 26, without him, who can eat or find enjoyment? To the man who pleases him, or woman, God gives wisdom and knowledge and happiness so that you can enjoy those good things. Wisdom to know how to enjoy them, knowledge and happiness. But to the sinner, he gives the task of gathering and storing up wealth to hand it over to the one who pleases God. And then I think he's saying here, this too is a vanity of chasing after wind. He's saying, even this will end. Even this will pass. See, he's saying there is a time when the party will end. And the question will not be at the end, did you enjoy yourself? The question is, did you know the one who was running the party? The one whose party it was? And then the question will be, did you thank him for all the pleasure? Or did you just take and take